Kane woke instantly, upper body tensing and dislodging Fan's head from his shoulder. For a split second, he wasn't certain what had awakened him. Then he realized it wasn't a noise, but rather a sudden cessation of one. The steady throb of the diesel engines had faded completely. The disappearance of the sound had penetrated his sleeping mind and prodded his point man's sense into raising an alarm. Consulting his wrist chron, he saw by the glowing digits he had been sleeping for around 3 hours, which meant he and Fand had been in the brig nearly 12. Fand rubbed her eyes with the heels of her hands.
What's going on?
Kane cocked his head, listening intently.
I think that was the anchor. We've arrived.
Quail appeared on the other side of the bars, smiling benignly like a maimed Buddha. A Beretta M92 was nestled in his huge hand, almost swallowed by it.
Ah, we're in sight of our destination, and your presence is required above. I'm sure our Spirit of Ireland here will have some fascinating observations to share with us.
He reached out with one beam-like arm and pulled the lever on the bulkhead. Solenoids clicked open, and Quail slid back the brig's door. Not waiting for the man and woman to stir from the bunk, he walked carefully backward down the passage.
Let's not dawdle.
Fand and Kane exchanged brief glances and left the cell. Kane's leg was stiff, and each step sent little flares of pain through the thigh, but he managed to walk without limping. By the time they reached the stairway, Quail was already standing on the deck.
Move along now.
They emerged under a sullen sky and a cloud-wreathed sun sinking to the horizon. The windless ocean swelled in long, slow waves that rocked the tangled kelp and seagrass up and down. Quail wordlessly pointed to starboard, and they turned in that direction. At first glance, they saw only dark crags rising from the languid surf. Upon second glance, Kane felt the prickling of dread at the nape of his neck. The first thing he noticed was it wasn't an island at all, but more of a rocky atoll, projecting out of the ocean like the fist of a stone giant. The rim of the atoll rose straight up from the water. No shoreline was visible, nor any kind of beach at all. A deep, asymmetrical cleft climbed from the breakers between the rocks, and in the depression, Kane saw a great flight of green-slimed stone steps. They led up to a tumble of rock blocks, like the ruins of a huge wall, behind which loomed an edifice covered in dried mud. Barely visible behind the coating of mud, a huge bas-relief carving of a squid or an octopus waved its tentacles. The hoist lowered the small skiff over the side of the Cromwell. Under the watchful eye of Quail and the barrel of an MP5 subgun, Fand and Kane scaled a rope ladder to the skiff. After they were seated, Quail tossed Kane a big, box-batteried xenon flashlight. It could project a beam of 3 million candle power. Quail swung over the rail and climbed down with surprising agility for one of his mammoth bulk. Hanging from his belt were 3 empty sacks made of a dense black fabric. They were sealed with Velcro tabs. Also thrust through his belt was his cutlass. Still keeping Fand and Kane in front of his blaster, he started the outboard motor clamped to the squared-off stern with a single yank of the pull cord. He gunned the throttle, the prow riding on a rush of foam. The small craft was barely 8 feet long, having contours similar to a bathtub, but it skimmed across the sea smoothly. The wind was biting, and Fan rubbed her bare arms, but she made no complaint. Quail piloted the boat expertly over the breakers at the mouth of the stone stairs. Waves lapped over the sides, soaking their feet, the salt spray stinging their eyes. Quail steered the skiff slowly to the foot of the stairs between dark ramparts of rock. Then the hull grated on stone, and he cut the engine. He tossed a mooring line to Kane, who climbed out and looped it securely around a rock. Fand and Kane preceded Quail up the weather-eroded stairway, climbing between the black walls rearing above them like permanent thunderclouds. Not speaking, the three people scaled the crude, time-pitted stone slabs, picking their way carefully. In some places, the steps were slippery with lichens and kelp. They made their way up the steep slant, boot soles slipping and sliding on the wet rock. It leveled off at the mouth of the paving stone path that wound around a vista of ruins. Massive stone blocks, twice as high as Quail, lay in scattered profusion, many of them sheathed in verdigris-eaten bronze. Paving slabs were cracked and upended, all draped with strands of seaweed. They waded ankle-deep through fetid ooze. Quail seemed as awed as Fand and Cain, but he wasn't so entranced that he forgot to keep them before the barrel of the autoblaster. Inscribed on several monoliths, beneath the dried crustings of muck, they saw the squid motif.
What's with the octopus symbol?
It's a kraken. A monster variety of squid. Extinct long ago, but there were allegedly sightings of them in historical times. Every Atlantean outpost has its own sigil identifying it with the ocean. Whales, sharks, seahorses.
I had no idea you were such an expert, Captain.
Oh, I'm full of surprises, sister. As your little slut spy Morgan learned. I dare say I've performed more research on the subject of Atlantis than anyone in the past 2 centuries.
The three of them walked to the silt-coated edifice they had seen from the ship. It was partly fallen in, but the portico, upheld by 4 marble columns, was still intact. Along the edge of the roof, a row of horn-headed stone gargoyles leered down, statues of monsters of bygone epochs, half-human and half-beast. The mixtures, thought Cain, of Atlantean legends. There was no gate, no door. The portal stood open and empty. Quail motioned to Cain.
If you would be so kind as to light our way, sir.
They went beneath the lintled arch into dimness and a brooding silence. The xenon cast an almost solid rod of white before them. Cain walked carefully on the bare, slimy stone floor, unconsciously slipping into the point man's persona despite the circumstances. His eyes roamed from side to side, searching every nook and corner. He sensed nothing but ancient, bygone times, the shadows of long-gone presences. The corridor was completely empty, even of debris. The passage ended after 20 yards, and an unrailed stairway plunged down into impenetrable darkness. Cain stood at its head, the incandescent beam of the flashlight illuminating only the first few steps. Quail prodded Fand hard in the small of the back with the bore of the subgun. Cain took the first step down into the yawning blackness. The light gleamed on a strange, sleek, glossy substance coating the walls, suggestive of ceramic or enamel. He assumed they were below sea level now, and the composition of the walls kept out the water. The stairs ended in an oval chamber, and by casting about the light, Cain saw the rubble of decayed furniture, scattered rags of tapestries, moldering heaps of trash, and scatterings of rotten, soggy wood. Mixed in with the wood was a litter of oddly shaped metal bits, like the clasps and locks of jewelry or storage boxes. At the far end of the chamber, rising on a pedestal, was a small statue of a kraken, tentacles curving up and over its cylindrical body. It appeared to be made of the same slightly reflective ceramic substance as on the walls. On closer inspection, the kraken and the pedestal itself seemed to be molded out of the wall that backed them, as if it were all one continuous piece. Cain shone the xenon all around.
Congratulations, Quail. You've discovered the city dump of Lioness.
Move to the side, but keep your light on the statue. If you shine it in my eyes, I'll open fire very, very indiscriminately. Even if I can't see you in these close quarters, I'll kill at least one of you.
Cain watched as Quail carefully inspected the kraken, running his fingers all over the tentacles. Quail had the index finger of one hand inserted up to the first joint into a raised sucker ring of a tentacle. He threw a preening smile toward Cain and Fand as if he expected congratulations.
So, the arm is hollow.
Still smiling, Quail removed from a jacket pocket a small sphere, holding it between thumb and forefinger. With a slight start, Cain recognized it from his jump dream communication with Fand. He realized it bore the same glassy sheen as the walls of the chamber. Quail placed the bead of orichalcum into the sucker ring, fitting it perfectly on the molded rim. He tapped it, and the orb disappeared, clicking and rolling down the hollow tentacle. From the saucer-shaped eyes of the kraken beat a slow pulse of uncolored light. The wall to which the statue and pedestal were attached shivered, then began to rotate, turning a U-curve on invisible pivots. Stale, fetid air gusted out, ruffling Cain's and Fan's hair and causing even Quail to reflexively lift a hand to his nose. With the barrel of the MP5, he gestured to the opening.
Ladies and prisoners first.
Squaring his shoulders, the short hairs at the back of his neck bristling, Cain stepped through the opening, the flashlight striking dull reflections on the glossy walls. The room was huge and long and filled with darkness. Dim shapes towered all around them in the gloom. An immense statue loomed in the center of the chamber, rearing from a plinth of greenish-black stone. The effigy dwarfed everything else in the room, rising at least 20 feet high. It possessed humanoid legs and hips, but the upper body had the form of the kraken, with 6 tentacled arms, 3 on each side. The beaked head sported little nubbin horns, and the eyes in the blank face were fist-sized gemstones.
Belial, I presume. Here is where his sons were made.
Kane followed the short sweep of the subgun's barrel and saw a dais of the same black-green stone, crafted into the likeness of many loopings of heavy chain, fantastically interwoven. The length of chain swarmed with monstrosities. The links were grotesque faces, deformed heads sporting stubby horns. A pair of chains crossed above the dais, and where the 2 strands intersected hung a face of horror, with fanged mouth agape in a demonic howl. Absently, Kane noted the dark circular hollow behind the molded tongue. The floor of the dais was a many-faceted convex disc of red-tinted crystalline stone, like semi-opaque quartz. He estimated it as at least 5 feet in diameter. Suspended above it by ceramic chains was an identical crystal disc, but this one was concave. Kane glanced toward Fand and saw her face filled with loathing. She was not looking at the statue or the dais. Spreading out from a corner, piled high in a pyramid, were dozens, perhaps even scores, of yellowed skulls. Almost all of them appeared to be malformed, with back-sloping foreheads and bony ridges jutting out over empty eye sockets. Twisted little knobs projected from the craniums, some of them blunt, others long and curved, like the horns of a ram.
The birthing ward of the Firbolgs. Unholy mixtures of animal and man.
Kane tried to control the nausea leapfrogging in his belly. He thought of Jacko, of the hybrids, and even of Fand, who was herself a hybrid. The obsession to toy with the very essence of creation hadn't begun with the totality concept, or even the Nazis. Kane shifted the flashlight away from the stacked, grinning skulls and played it over a recess in the wall. A figure sat there, on a seat of the glassy stone roughly hewed into the likeness of a chair. It appeared to be the cadaver of a man wearing ornate armor, the fleshless head tilted back with the mouth hanging open. He didn't devote any time to wondering who the man might have been or why he was sitting there. His eyes were drawn to the naked broadsword lying at the corpse's feet. Though the metal was dulled, the blade was well over 3 feet in length. Kane didn't linger over it. He swept the xenon beam around, pretending to be fascinated by the friezes and geometric forms carved on the walls.
I don't see your balls, Captain.
That's because you look, but you do not see.
Quayle's gaze was fixed upon the monstrous effigy of Belial, smiling up at it beatifically. Kane followed his cyclopean stare, casting the flashlight onto it. The brilliant beam struck little twinkles of incandescence on the swarm of tentacles. Embedded in each one of the sucker rings gleamed orbs of orichalcum.
What are you going to do now, Balor? Pry them out and ship them back to England and blow your entire country to atoms?
Hardly my country.
The beads of orichalcum are highly unstable. Without the proper machinery, you'd be far safer transporting a boatload of plutonium.
Quayle patted one of the black bags at his belt.
As long as the beads aren't exposed directly to the sun and don't absorb solar rays, the safety factor is acceptable.
That's what Morrigan wanted you to believe.
I've done my own research.
Not nearly enough of it. Otherwise, you'd know it takes only one bead of orichalcum to trigger a chain reaction. If one bead detonates, it will touch off all the others in the vicinity, regardless of whether you have them in a sunless and airtight container or not. It'll be a firestorm of the likes not seen since the cataclysm that tore the world asunder and sank Atlantis and all her colonies millennia ago.
Quayle squinted with his good eye, gesturing to orbs on the statue's 6 arms.
Why didn't those ignite during the cataclysm?
Several reasons. First of all, the stuff this vault is made out of probably acts as shielding, like vanadium alloy or lead. Not only can light not penetrate, but neither can whatever radiation the Orichalcum emits.
Not to mention there is 1,000,000 square miles of ocean between here and where the Atlantean homeland was supposedly located, near the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. Lioness wasn't spared the tsunamis or earth changes, but its supply of Orichalcum was protected.
Morrigan wanted me to take the beads back to England so I'd destroy it?
Exactly. She was willing to sacrifice herself if it meant turning Britain into a cinder.
And you don't want that to happen?
No. I am a protector of life, a creator of it, not a destroyer. Even if the Orichalcum could be restricted only to England, I would still try to prevent such a catastrophe. Now that Strongbow no longer rules England, now that the Imperium is no more, our two nations with their intertwined histories should become one people. The divisions should end between us. Don't you see that's the only logical course to take, Aubrey?
Kane watched Quayle's face during Fan's brief appeal to reason and saw indecision. But with her use of his name, his head swiveled swiftly toward her.
Aubrey, and Morrigan called me my captain. And what do you call me, Kane? Evil Eye? Balor? The fat bastard?
Kane kept his own suggestions to himself. Quayle took a quick sidestep and slammed the frame of the MP5 against the side of Fan's head.
Ah!
She staggered across the chamber and fell, long arms and legs asprawl.
Bastard!
Kane made a blind, instinctive lunge for Quayle, and the man pounded the butt of the subgun into the pit of his belly. As he folded over in the direction of the sickening blow, Quayle jacked up a knee against his chin. It was like being kicked by a redwood. Kane fell onto his side, dropping the xenon flashlight as he did so. It fell over, the beam glancing in sparkling pinpoints from the gemstones in the idol's eyes. Quayle kicked Kane's injured thigh.
Get up! Get the fuck up! Get up and start pulling the Orichalcum out of those fucking arms!
Fiery agony spread up and down Kane's leg as he forced himself to his elbows.
Pull your own fucking arms, Aubrey.
Blood streaming down her face, Fan bounded toward Quayle, the broadsword held in a two-fisted grip. Her golden eyes seethed with the wild fury of the Fan who was one with the hills, the winds, and the gray seas of Era. The mad Fan. She swung the huge sword like a cleaver. All Kane could think of to do was scramble out of her way. The point of the sword snagged in the loose folds of Quayle's throat, but it only pierced the outer flesh, drawing a fine thread of blood bright against the stark pallor of his complexion. He backpedaled as fast as his bulk would allow, bringing up his MP5. He squeezed off only a single round before the sword swept across and clanged against the barrel of the blaster, ripping it from his hands and sending it flying. It clattered end over end onto the crystal floor dais. The one shot took Fan high in the chest. Kane saw a scrap of the combat vest fly away, exposing the metal mesh beneath. The pile-driving impact rocked her back on her heels and drove most of the air from her lungs. As she staggered, leather-shod feet rasping for purchase on the floor, she hurled the broadsword straight up, point first. Kane shot out an arm, and his hand closed around the hilt. He spun around to face Quayle, whose white face was twisted in fury as he drew his cutlass. Kane hefted the broadsword with one hand. As he stared at Quayle, for just an instant, a fleeting microsecond, the man's bleached flesh and uniform rippled away like water sluicing over a pane of dusty glass. He saw Balor facing him, his gray beard plaited in two thick braids upon his chest. The image faded almost immediately.
This was a long time in coming between you and me, Evil Eye.
Quayle's eye flickered in momentary confusion. His chalk-colored lips twitched.
Kane? Cain?
Kane lunged. Quayle met the attack by hacking wildly, his blade gleaming brightly in the illumination shed by the xenon. Kane kept his sword from being knocked out of line as the two men circled each other. He used the heavier broadsword to drive Quayle backward. The huge man didn't care for a forced retreat. He closed in, body to body, blades crossed and locked. For a long second, they stood eye to eye with each other. Quayle drove his head forward between the edges of the two swords, trying to butt Kane in the face. He sliced open his left cheek in the attempt. Pushing off from Quayle, using his enormous body as a springboard, Kane slammed back against the plinth supporting the idol of Belial. Quayle pressed his advantage, hammering away with his cutlass as if to beat Kane to his knees. Kane blocked and parried. It was all he could do to hold onto the broadsword handle while the giant albino smashed and battered at him. Kane's right arm began to lose all feeling, the strength sweeping away. A fireball of agony burned in his shoulder socket. He placed both hands beneath the crossguard and tried to knock the cutlass aside long enough for him to get away from the statue. Quail's blade was a constant flicker of light. It lashed past Kane's guard, and its keen edge hissed along his collarbone before a beat of the broadsword knocked it clear. Kane felt the slow spread of blood beneath his shirt. He had no choice but to leap backward to avoid the razored blade. The back of his head bumped smartly against the curve of a curling tentacle, and he stumbled. Quail moved in to deliver a killing stroke. Kane ducked aside at the last microsecond. The cutlass bit deeply into the tentacle, shearing through it, but the 400-year-old blade broke on impact. The top half of the sword splintered and fell to the floor beside the sliced-off piece of statuary. The little sphere of orichalcum rolled away from the tentacle.
No!
Eye bulging in its socket, Quail gaped at the jagged stump of his precious cutlass as if trying to convince himself that a trick of the light gave it only the illusion of being snapped in half.
No!
He flung down the hilt and lumbered to retrieve the MP5. Kane knew trying to tackle the behemoth would have the same effect as body blocking a mountain. Quail would just carry him piggyback to the dais. His toe nudged the orb of orichalcum and it rolled across the floor. Glancing up, Kane focused on the open hole of the carved demonic face above the dais. He dropped the sword, bent over, snatched up the little sphere, and raced after Quail. The big man had a 3-yard head start, but Kane didn't have Quail's extra 200-plus pounds of weight slowing him up. He could have easily caught or passed him, but Kane stayed at his heels. Reaching the edge of the dais, Quail half-jumped, half-crawled onto the crystal disc. He stooped, fumbling to pick up the subgun. As he bent over, Kane leaped up, slapped the orichalcum bead precisely into the mouth of the lasciviously grinning demon face, and threw himself to the right. Quail whirled around, teeth bared in a grimace of homicidal fury. He worked the MP5's trigger, spraying a wild storm of lead in Kane's general direction. Kane somersaulted frantically, trying to roll ahead of the deadly copper-jacketed stream. The slugs slashed long trenches in the chamber floor, showering him with rock chips. The facets of the crystals above and below Quail winked with the strobing muzzle flash of the subgun. They danced with inner sparks, seeming to gather the flickering light into themselves until they glowed with a throbbing flame. A nimbus of luminescence spilled from above and crept up from below, swiftly encasing Quail's body in a shimmering skein of witchfire. At first, the maddened man was oblivious to the phenomenon. Only when he was completely veiled by the wavering cocoon did he stop firing. He looked around wildly and made a convulsive lurch to leave the dais. The convulsion turned into a spasm, one rippling shudder following the other until his entire body quaked, as if vibrating violently from within. He writhed, his eye wide and staring, saliva spilling from his slack lips. He dropped the MP5. His hairless scalp squirmed in a half dozen different places, as if tiny worms wriggled and burrowed just beneath the flesh. The white skin stretched and split amid little spurting geysers of blood. Rising to a crouch, Kane saw blunt-tipped horns sprouting from his skull, punching through the flesh. The man clutched both sides of his head, his tongue protruding from his mouth. It was black and wet, then red as a gush of scarlet spewed from between his gaping jaws. The fabric of his sleeves over his elbows stretched out, then ripped as scarlet-coated spurs of bone erupted in a vermilion mist. Quail's body sagged. The right side of his face hung slackly from the bone like wax exposed to great heat. Then the flesh fell away and lay in a quivering lump of protoplasm on the disc. Quail turned his head, one entire side of it nothing but reddened bone.
You were right. I should have done more research.
His body fell flat on the crystal, and after a few twitches of feet and fingers, he moved no more. Head spinning, Kane climbed to his feet, not able to tear his eyes away from the transformation Quail's body was still undergoing. Fand made her slow, stiff way over to him, face crimson-streaked, the braid in her hair loosened. He put an arm around her, and she leaned into him, wincing.
You all right?
Aside from a desperate headache, I think I may have a cracked clavicle. But our skins are whole, more or less.
Which is more than can be said for him.
She kissed him on the cheek.
I knew only you would be able to best Balor, Cain.
Cain.
How did you know how to activate the machine with the orichalcum, if you are only Cain?
He swept his gaze over the statue of Belial, about to tell her how he, Cain, not Cain, reasoned out the process due to his own experiences over the past year. Then he saw Belial's tentacles exuding a gibbous glow like captured moonbeams. All of the beads embedded in the swirl of arms gleamed. Fan saw it too.
You did more than activate the machine. You triggered a chain reaction.
How? The beads weren't exposed to solar radiation.
How do I know? These devices haven't been used in thousands and thousands of years. They're probably as unstable as the energy that powers them.
Shit!
Kane pivoted on a heel and dragged Fand in a sprint across the chamber. She shook loose, and long legs pumping outdistanced him within seconds. When they pushed through the opening, Fand grasped the carved image of the Kraken.
Give me a hand. If we seal up the chamber, it might contain the energy.
Kane didn't need to hear the rest. Clutching the tentacles, he hurled his entire weight into a muscle-cracking shove, the toes of his boots digging into the floor. For a long, heart-stopping second, nothing happened. It was like trying to uproot the temple itself. Then their combined strength prevailed, and the curved section of the wall slowly shifted. It joined seamlessly with the stone blocks, thudding solidly into place. Body quivering with exertion, Kane raced after the sprinting Fan up the dark staircase, and then in a crazed dash down the long corridor and out of the building. Fan still maintained the lead when they reached the stone steps leading to the sea. She leaped down them four at a time. Kane followed her closely, not daring to look behind him. A single misstep could pitch him headlong into a neck-breaking fall. They piled aboard the skiff, casting off the line. Kane piloted it in a reckless swerve, the hull scraping on half-submerged rocks. The boat roared across the water, bouncing as violently as a stone skimming the surface of a pond. When they had covered a little more than half the distance to where the Cromwell lay at anchor, Kane dared to cast a glance over his shoulder. The craggy atoll looked exactly the same as when they'd first seen it.
If something was going to happen, shouldn't it have by now?
The world staggered. An intolerable white glare filled his eyes. The sea heaved, and the boat catapulted forward, riding mountainous ridges of flying foam. The skiff rose high on a rolling torrent, turning sideways, then flipping upside down. Kane tried to cling to something, sought to reach Fand, but he plunged into the sea with such force that he felt his bones compress. Even as the sea buffeted him, tossed him like a cork, he was aware of the thundering vibration of destruction. The Orichalcum's detonating energy, pent up in the vault below sea level, had burst forth in an apocalyptic torrent. He rolled helplessly, seeing nothing, not knowing in which direction lay the surface or the bottom. There was nothing for him to do but somehow stay alive. His lungs ached, and blood roared in his head as he was swept and tumbled along by wave after wave of concussive force. He felt a pounding, as of immense hammers upon his brain. Then a vast numbness. Water seeped into his mouth, and he struggled to keep from inhaling it, clamping his lips tight. Then a hand took one of his. His eyes, squeezed shut against the unholy glare, opened and saw cool, greenish light, not the incandescent ball of hellfire that had scorched across the sky. Fand floated above him, her long, unbound hair flowing around her head like a luminous veil. Her golden eyes were blank, lost in shock. Dark red clouds puffed from around her ears. Slowly, Kane kicked his leaden legs and moved them both toward the surface. Her own legs began to stir, sluggishly at first, then with more determination. Their heads broke the surface together. They dog-paddled in the shallow troughs between the rough waves, gasping and retching, vomiting out the water they had swallowed.
I'm deaf. I'm deaf!
Your eardrums have ruptured. You'll recover.
She gave him an angry glare.
I can't hear you!
Kane turned in the direction of the atoll and saw only a great bubbling froth from which shifting rays of smoky pink light shone, like the aurora borealis as seen through several layers of cloud cover.
Look!
Kane turned around and saw the Cromwell still at anchor, bobbing up and down in the last of the giant ripples. She was less than 20 yards away. With a bit of surprise, Kane realized they had been pushed for nearly half a mile by the shockwave. Cutting a white wake off the Cromwell's port side chugged Hornblower's Wraith. Kane was able to see Grant and Finn standing on the deck in front of the wheelhouse. Fand began to stroke toward the black ship.
Dodd can still fire on them!
Even as Kane swam after her, gritting his teeth at the acidic burn of brine in his cuts, the door to the Cromwell's bridge opened. Dodd appeared, frantically waving a square of white cloth at the Wraith. She turned her beautiful, bruised face to Kane, her eyes alight with exuberance. She clutched at him, grabbing handfuls of his sodden shirt.
It's all over now. The Imperium is defeated, and hell rose and sank again.
Kane managed to muster a weak smile. Now that it was done, he was too exhausted to care. All he could think about was Bridget Baptiste and what she might be thinking or dreaming. After turning Trillium over to the stable hand, Brigid started to return to the house, but on impulse turned up the path to the formal gardens. Still in glorious bloom this fall, the garden with its huge rhododendron hedges and winding paths had always drawn her like a magnet from the time she was a small child. The winding path she now walked had aromatic herbs growing in its crevices. The mint in particular released a fragrance that always lifted her spirits. But today, not even the garden could claim all the disturbing thoughts that swirled through her mind. She had a sense of great events building in the distance, and she knew somehow Captain Kane was involved with them. When she entered the house through the solarium doors, she was surprised and not at all happy to find Paul Delmas waiting for her. He was wearing a beautifully tailored riding habit, and he swished the crop through the air in annoyance.
"Where have you been? I thought we were to ride together."
Brigid let him wait for a reply. Something of a dandy, Paul was amazingly handsome and tailored to a fault. Brigid could picture him spending hours before a glass, his patient valet in attendance, turning first this way, then that, posing first with one outfit, then another, searching the flaxen-haired reflection for that elusive, perfect look. With his charm, dandified good looks, and money, he'd seemed at first to be the perfect match for Brigid. Temperamentally, they were extremely unsuited for each other.
"I'm waiting, Brigid."
"Oh, do be quiet, Paul. It simply slipped my mind."
Paul gazed at her for 1 second with an emotion that bordered on shock, but quickly transmuted into patronizing amusement.
"Why, Brigid, you're unusually sharp-tongued today. Is something the matter? May I be of assistance?"
He stepped close to her and, firmly grasping her elbows, drew her close to him. She tried to withdraw from his grasp without seeming repulsed, which she most definitely was.
"Brigid, you must tell me what this is all about. Tell me everything immediately and stop being a silly goose."
She didn't know what to tell him about anything, much less everything. She felt herself withdrawing, not just from him, but from her entire life, as if it were unreal, taking on the quality of a dream. Bernard, the butler, eyed Paul Delmas from the foyer. Paul swiftly released Brigid, stepping away. The old white-haired servant proffered a silver salver to Brigid, upon which lay a small white calling card, face down. Lips pursed in distaste, Bernard glanced at Brigid.
"You have a visitor, mademoiselle? A gentleman. He awaits you in the garden."
Brigid glanced through the glass-paneled door and saw the figure of a man pacing impatiently back and forth between the rose bed and grape arbor. She couldn't understand why she hadn't seen him when she walked past them just moments before. His face was in shadow, but the sun glinted from the silver knob and ferrule of his cane. Cane. Brigid picked up the card and read the handwritten inscription on the obverse side. She read the flowing cursive script.
"I'm waiting for you. Come back to me, Anamkara."
Turning away from Paul, Brigid hurried toward the door.
"Who is this so-called gentleman? I demand you tell me his name at once."
She paid him no heed, turning the brass door handles and stepping out into a white, antiseptic world. Instead of the perfume of flowers, she smelled the scent of sterilizing fluids, of starched and laundered sheets. Instead of the sun, she saw neon strips shedding an artificial glow. She felt a light, warm pressure on her right hand. Everything was fuzzy, blurred around the edges, so she blinked them into focus. Kane sat beside her in a chair, head bowed, eyes closed as if he were sleeping. He looked exhausted to the point of being ill, his face pale and drawn tight over the facial bones, his hair in disarray. Her hand was nestled in his palm. Brigid's tongue felt like a shriveled strip of shoe leather. Kane's head snapped up, eyes widening. They were weary eyes, worried eyes, red-netted and wet. He leaned over her urgently, tightening his grip on her hand.
"Brigid?"
She noted absently how he addressed her by her first name, not as Baptiste. With effort, she raised her left hand and ran her fingers through his tousled hair.
"I got your message."
Kane gave her an inscrutable look for a long moment, then nodded as if he understood completely. Brigid knew he did. Outlander's Hell Rising is a Graphic Audio production. Outlanders and all characters are trademarks owned by Harlequin Enterprises Limited, used by others under license. Copyright 2000, Worldwide Library, all rights reserved. Production copyright 2008, The Cutting Corporation, all rights reserved. Performed by Terence Aselford, Nanette Savard, Thomas Penny, Richard Rowan, Colleen Delaney, Ann Flosnick, Dolores King-Williams, David Coyne, Ken Jackson, Michael John Casey, James Lewis, Tom Simpson, Christopher Graybill, James Konacek, Dylan Lynch, and Mort Shelby. Additional red shirts by The Dead Giveaways. Adapted for graphic audio by Cheryl Hayes. Directed by Terence Aselford. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornette. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Brian Patton, Nathaniel Perry, and Chris Rowan. The Outlanders theme was composed by Norman Vanderslice. Additional original music by Nathaniel Perry and Brian Patton. If you enjoyed Outlanders, be sure to look for James Axler's Deathlands. Available at Road Stops Everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our Action Pump titles, as well as free downloadable extras, forums, and podcasts. Keep listening for another episode of Mark Dalton, Owner-Operator.
Audio presents Mark Dalton, Owner-Operator. Book number 2, Reefer Madness and More Tales of the Open Road by Ido Van Belkin. Copyright 2008, Ido Van Belkin. Performed by David Coyne and the Graphic Audio Players. Episode number 8, Big Time Owner-Operator.
Elliot Atherton, the software company CEO whose daughter Mark saved from a certain rape by the side of the highway, had been good to his word. The man had paid for the repairs to Motherlode, compensated Mark for the late penalties on his load, he'd avoided any late charges but figured $500 was fair, and he'd given Mark another $500 just as a way of saying thank you. Now Motherlode was back in top shape, cruising down Highway 400 as smooth as silk, and looking like she just drove off the showroom floor. But despite the truck's condition, Mark couldn't help but think that Motherlode was on her last legs, at least with himself behind the wheel. After all, in the past few months, she'd been trashed by a bunch of punks, been in a scrape with a truck driven by a kidnapper, and bashed in by a highway meeting with a deer. He hated the thought of selling the old girl since Mark and Motherlode had been through so much together, but the time seemed right. She had 800,000 kilometers on her and shined like a fresh loony. If there was ever a time that Mark could get the most resale value out of her, that time was now.
Maybe in a couple weeks I'll take out an ad. That would give me some time to clean her up inside and get myself ready to say goodbye.
Just then, a minivan in the left lane pulled right, cutting off a station wagon in the center lane and sending it swerving onto the shoulder. A cloud of dust exploded off the shoulder as the rear end of the wagon cut a swath through the gravel.
Oh, shit!
Mark lifted his foot off the accelerator and got on the brake. The wagon's rear wheels caught in the dirt, and the back end of the car swung back out onto the highway. Mark jammed on the brake. That was a close one. Another second or two, and Motherlode would have plowed into the wagon, wiping out the family and destroying the truck's front end once again. Mark set the parking brake and switched on his hazard lights.
Guess the time to sell is now, while I still have a truck to sell.
Just then, Motherlode's air pressure valve let go with a sharp blast, almost as if the big machine were answering Mark.
Uh-huh.
Mark nodded once, then got out to see if anyone was hurt. After making his delivery outside Toronto, Mark decided not to call Bud for his next load until he'd taken the time to check out new truck prices at a few dealerships around town. But while most of them were offering competitive packages, and any of the new makes and models would have been an improvement over the 8-year-old Motherlode, Mark wasn't about to change brands. Mother Lode was a Peterbilt 379, and she'd served him well over the years. If he was going to buy another truck, it would be a new 379 with many of the bells and whistles that modern technology had to offer. Mark pulled into the Roadway Truck Center lot around 4 in the afternoon. He had barely parked Mother Lode and was about to shut her down when he noticed a man stepping through the dealership's front door, heading straight for him. He was wearing dark pants, a light-colored shirt, and a striped tie. His hair was neatly trimmed, yet slightly mussed, as if he'd spent time in front of the mirror to get each hair exactly out of place, just enough to make it look like he didn't care all that much what his hair looked like.
Must have smelled me pulling in.
Woo-wee! Beautiful day, isn't it?
Mark looked up and saw several dark clouds looming.
If you're a duck, maybe.
Hey, you've got a sense of humor. I can tell we're gonna get along just famously.
Not goddamn likely.
How can I help you?
Interested in trading in for a new truck, a new 379.
Brand new?
Mark nodded.
Well, we've got a good selection of new trucks on the lot, and if we don't have it, we'll order it for you, no problem.
Every dealer I've been to has said that.
I'll tell you what. You'll find yourself the best deal you can, and we'll not only match it, but we'll beat it by $2,000.
Sounds good.
Damn right it is.
The salesman threw his thumb in the direction of Motherlode.
So, you looking to trade this one in?
Mark nodded.
How many clicks?
800,000.
Ooh, that's a lot of mileage. We'd probably have to do a lot of work to get it up to Roadway's pre-owned vehicle standard of excellence.
Yeah, right. Standard's my ass. The truck runs like a top, and it's never looked as good.
Yeah, I'll give you that. But if it's running so good, why are you getting rid of it?
Because I can afford to buy a new one.
Hey, my kind of customer knows what he wants and doesn't like to beat around the bush.
The man flashed a smile that had no doubt been perfected by years of practice in front of a mirror.
And that's why I'm not going to haggle with you. Of course, I'd have to have our mechanics check it over, but I'd say I could probably offer you, say, $35,000 in trade.
What?
I know, it's a good offer, but I'm willing to stick to it no matter what our mechanics find.
Mark was more than a little insulted. Motherlode was worth $50,000 easy, especially with all the new paint and bodywork. He'd seen other 379s advertised for as much, some of them with more mileage on them.
That's about $15,000 less than what I expected.
Hey, we've got to put some money into the truck before we resell it. We've got a business to run, you know.
It was obvious that they were able to undercut other dealers by $2,000 on the sale price of a new truck because they would stiff the buyer $15,000 on his trade-in.
You're not the only one running a business.
If you think you can get more selling the truck on your own, go ahead. But then you've got to take out an ad and leave the truck someplace where people can look at it and hope it doesn't get damaged or vandalized before you complete a sale.
He had a point there. Mark was always on the road and would need to let Motherlode sit for a few weeks so buyers could see it. Then he'd have to turn around to sign papers and close the deal.
Or maybe you could hire someone to drive it for you. You know, start your own fleet.
What did you say?
Hire someone to drive your truck. You know, be a real big-time owner-operator with your own truck fleet.
Huh. That's not a bad idea. Not a bad idea at all.
After all, how hard could it be to manage two trucks instead of one? Mark bought his new 379 from a dealer in Northern Ontario, choosing to buy there because the salesman never lied to him, never promised him anything, and simply shrugged his shoulders when Mark balked at his trade-in offer on Motherlode. That had been a week ago, and in 3 more days, Mark would be taking ownership of his new truck. 400-plus horsepower, overdrive transmission, engine brake, upper bunk, and as many extended warranties as he could afford. He decided on a dark shade of green and asked that the name, Motherlode 2, be painted in small, inconspicuous script on each side of the sleeper. He paid 3/4 of the sales price in cash, leaving the rest for monthly payments. In the meantime, he was interviewing drivers for Motherlode at a Tim Hortons in the east end of Brampton near the airport. The area was crawling with drivers, and Mark figured he'd be able to hire one easy, then have a couple of days off before they delivered his new truck on Friday. That had been the plan, but he was into his second day of interviews and was starting to think that all kinds of people wanted to drive a truck for a living, but nobody wanted to actually work for a living. Like this guy sitting across the table from him. He was a young guy, decent looking, and had a clean abstract. He seemed to be on the ball, too, until Mark began telling him about the job.
We do a lot of long hauling, so it wouldn't be unusual for you to make a trip west, stopping in Brandon, Regina, Edmonton, and Vancouver, and then making the same kind of stops on the way back again.
Hello, Vancouver. Takes a while to drive out there.
Yeah, it's kind of far away.
But I don't want to work any weekends. My wife...
Then you're in luck.
I am?
Yep. The Monday to Friday 9-to-5 trucking company is interviewing at the coffee time down the street. If you hurry, you just might catch him before all the good routes are gone.
Gee, thanks. Ass.
The next driver dropped by a half hour later. He was a young guy in his 20s wearing a new Mac ball cap and a pair of freshly washed jeans.
You okay working weekends?
Weekends? Sure, no problem.
Oh, good, good. And you don't mind driving long haul?
As long as I'm back every 5 days or so.
Oh?
Well, see, I got this girlfriend, and she is smoking hot. And I'm afraid if I'm gone more than 5 days, she'll find someone else to turn a crank. Know what I mean? And I don't like picking up or delivering in Quebec. They don't speak English very well there, and it feels like a whole different country.
Okay, then. I've got your number. I'll let you know.
You'll call me, right?
Sure.
The next guy through the door seemed perfect. Good driving record, clean cut, well-spoken, willing to work. Except for one small problem.
You're okay for the U.S., right?
Well, I'm not sure. I did a few years in New York State Pen for assaulting a police officer. But it was a long time ago. You think that's a problem?
Then there were a series of drivers who probably would have been excellent, conscientious, hard-working, and loyal, except for the fact that they didn't speak a word of English. Mark was about to give up hope when a young man sat down in front of him.
I couldn't help overhearing. You're looking for a driver, right?
That's right.
Well, your search is over, man. Mitch Murtaugh's the name.
Mark was dubious. Sure, the guy, Mitch, was old enough to have some driving experience, and he looked well enough groomed to be a fine representative of the company, but there was something about the way he came on that put Mark on edge.
You drive?
At 12 years.
Mitch pulled a few papers from an inside jacket pocket.
It's all there. Clean abstract, clean police record, letter of reference. And if you want the info that ain't there, I'll get it for you.
Wow. You work weekends?
Sure.
Extended periods away from home?
No problem. In fact, don't take this the wrong way, but sometimes the more I stay away from home, the better.
What sort of rate are you looking for?
Mitch told him, and they began working out an arrangement. When they were done, they shook hands.
Hey, when can I start?
As soon as you want.
How about right now?
Mark put a call into Bud, looking for a load for his driver.
Drive safe.
I will.
The salesman closed the door of Mark's brand new Peterbilt 379. Mark sat in the driver's seat, shoulders back, and head held high. Mark simply enjoyed the smell of his new truck. It was nice to know that no one had ever spilled coffee or farted on the seat, and that he would be the only one to ever spend the night in the sleeper.
It's gonna be fun driving this. Oh yeah, baby. Hello.
Hey, Mark. Yeah, it's Mitch. I got a flat on the right front tire.
Yeah, and?
Well, I thought you better get it fixed, since I can't drive it this way.
Of course, as a truck owner, it was up to Mark to arrange for such repairs so he could keep track of cost and quality of any repair.
Where are you?
Mitch gave Mark his exact location, on the side of the road near the military base in Trenton, Ontario. Mark checked his book of contracts and found he had a card from a company he'd done business with in Belleville.
Stay where you are and I'll send someone to you. Got it?
Yeah, no problem, boss.
Boss. Mark liked the sound of that. Mark Dalton, boss man. He called the company in Belleville and gave them the location of Mitch and Motherlode. After they assured him they'd be there in 20 minutes, Mark put Motherlode 2 into drive and headed south for his first load. Before he even reached his pickup point...
Oh, damn it, what now?
Mark was expecting it to be Mitch, but it wasn't.
This is Jerry from Wright Tire in Belleville. I'm in front of the entrance to the basin. There's no truck here. I asked the guy walking the road if he'd seen any truck, and he told me there'd been one here with a flat tire, but he got it changed and was gone about 2 minutes before he got here.
I told him to wait for you.
Well, he's not here now.
Sorry.
No problem. We got a minimum $50 charge for any service call. I'll send the invoice to you in the mail. Hello?
Where are you?
On the road, boss. Hauling ass.
Why didn't you wait for the truck I sent?
Oh, you called a guy? Sorry, I didn't know. I was waiting so long, I thought you forgot, so I made a call myself, and a guy came right away. Hey wanted to repair it, but I told him to give me a whole new tire, so he did. And it only cost you about $175. Isn't that great?
Yeah, great.
He hadn't been in business as an owner for more than a few days, and he was already a couple hundred dollars in the hole. Hopefully it was just a case of beginner's bad luck. After all, how much else could go wrong in his first week as an owner? Mark had been driving his new rig Motherload 2 for 3 days and couldn't be more pleased with the truck's performance. It was quieter, easier to drive, more comfortable, more fuel efficient, more everything than his previous truck that he wondered why he waited so long to make the upgrade to a newer model. Best of all, he hadn't received a phone call from Mitch in all that time, which Mark took to be a sign that everything was running smoothly. No news, after all, is good news. But by the end of the fourth day, when he still hadn't heard from his driver, Mark began to worry. If everything had gone according to plan, Mitch was supposed to have delivered his load last night in Montreal and then call him to let him know what was going on. But rather than wait any longer, Mark decided to call Mitch himself.
Yellow.
Yeah, Mitch, it's your boss, Mark.
Gotcha. I'm not here right now. Leave a message and I'll get back to you as soon as possible.
God damn it. Hey, bud. Mark here.
Mark Dalton?
Yes, Mark Dalton.
You need another load already?
No, I'm calling you about my driver, Mitch Murtaugh.
That guy's as crazy as you are. You know that?
You talked to him recently?
Yeah, he called from Montreal. I gave him a load into Ottawa.
When was that?
Yesterday. He was supposed to have called late last night, early this morning, for another load, but I haven't heard from him.
Thanks, bud.
Mark hung up and then tried Mitch's number again.
Yeah?
This is Mark Dalton calling.
Oh, hey, man. I've been meaning to call you.
Where are you?
Somewhere outside Fredericton.
What are you doing there? You're supposed to be in Ottawa.
Yeah, that's what I've been meaning to call you about. I was in Ottawa, but then I met up with this chick. Well, we sort of hit it off at a bar, and, well, she's got a rig of her own, and she offered me more money than you to team up with her. She's paying me more, and I'm getting laid every night. It's an awesome deal, man.
Oh, how the hell am I supposed to compete against a fringe benefit like that? Where's my truck?
Oh, not to worry, man. It's parked at a truck stop east of Gatineau. There's the manager of the place has the key, and he told me it'd be cool to park it there a few days.
Mark was seeing red. How could a driver forget about his obligations to his employer and just leave his truck stranded at a rest stop? As he shook his head, Mark realized it was easy when there was more money and feminine charms at work. Mitch might be getting some, but Mark was the one who was being screwed.
Where exactly is the truck?
Mitch gave Mark directions to the rest station and the manager's name.
Hey, how you be paying me for the load I drove for you?
Mark was speechless. This guy had left Mark high and dry, and now he was expecting to get paid for providing the inconvenience.
Oh, yeah, I'll put a check in the mail for you.
Man, can you send it express post? I could really use the money.
Better yet, I'll email it to you.
Thanks, man.
Jackass.
Mark hung up, wondering how long it would be before idiot Mitch realized you can't send checks over the internet. Mark made his delivery in Toronto, then parked Motherload in a fenced yard near the airport that had a security guard on duty at the front gate 24 hours a day. He'd have to pay to leave his truck there, but the peace of mind over the safety of his truck far outweighed any expense. Besides, all of his worry and concern these days was being spent on Motherlode, and what sort of shape he'd find her in when he got to Gatineau. Sure, the truck was parked in a safe place and the manager had a key, but that didn't mean there wouldn't be other people bumping into it or running keys along its body or pissing on its tires. Mark knew all of those things could happen to the truck quite easily, because he'd done all of them to other people's trucks over the years. Once Motherlode 2 was in place, Mark booked a car through a rental place that had an office in Ottawa that guaranteed him a lift out of Gatineau at no extra charge. All told, it took him half a day and $200 to get himself onto Highway 401 headed west. Mark could only shake his head. Less than a week in business and he was already out $400. And he was no better off than when he started. In fact, he was worse off because now he was right back where he started, with an extra truck and no driver. But now he had to get the truck back to Toronto and hire a new driver, which would take another couple of days, if he was lucky. To make matters worse, he now had a brand new truck on the road, and every day he spent dealing with his old truck was a day that his new truck wasn't making any money for him. In many ways, Mark felt like he was at the bottom of this deep hole, and every time he tried to crawl up the sides of it, the earth gave away, burying him a little bit deeper than before. And instead of the dirt collecting at the bottom of the hole, which would eventually raise him up to a level where he could climb out, the hole just kept getting deeper and deeper, with no chance of him ever getting out. It was enough to make Mark want to cry. But he wasn't about to do that. Not now. He was a smart, experienced driver, and this had been one little setback. Next time, he'd be a little smarter about how he'd go about hiring a driver, a little bit more careful about who he allowed behind the wheel of his beloved Motherlode. There had to be a few good drivers out there somewhere. He just had to find one, that's all. A few hours later, Mark was turning the car over to a clerk at the rental firm, then hopped into the car so the clerk could drive him out to Gatineau. The clerk was young, clean-cut, and called Mark sir every time he addressed him. Best of all, he drove the car smoothly, without any hard stops or rough starts.
Hey, you ever drive a truck?
Excuse me, sir?
Never mind.
When they got to the rest station outside Gatineau, they had to drive around to the lot twice before Mark recognized Motherlode parked in a corner between two tankers.
Is that it?
Yeah.
Motherlode was covered in dirt, and the whole right side had been spattered by something that looked like dark, dark mud. One headlight was broken, and there was a big dent in the front left fender like someone had dropped a bowling ball into it.
You want me to hang around?
No, that's fine. I'll be all right.
The clerk drove off, leaving Mark alone with Motherlode. He stood in front of the truck for several minutes just looking at it. It was clear to Mark now that the truck would be doomed as long as he owned it. Letting someone else drive it wasn't good enough. He had to divest himself of the truck before it took a blow that it wouldn't be able to recover from.
Sorry, Mother. You deserve better.
Mark wasn't sure what he was going to do, but one thing was for certain. Motherlode was not going to spend her twilight years as a hack in some greasy spoon. Mark made himself comfortable in the driver's seat and readied himself to take her home. Mark headed west down the 401 to Toronto, wondering why he was having such a bad string of luck with old Motherlode. Of all the drivers out there to choose from, he had to pick the grand prize winner, Mitch Murtaugh. Here was a guy who couldn't follow instructions. He'd been told to wait for Mark's tire man, had a misguided sense of initiative, called his own tire man while one was on the way, then asked for a new tire when a repair would have sufficed, had no problem leaving Mark hanging out to dry, left Motherlode in a parking lot in Gatineau without telling Mark, and had the gall to ask for money. Wanted his paycheck sent to him, probably with vacation pay included. The only thing understandable about the guy was that he'd left Mark to chase after a woman. Mark didn't agree with it, but at least he understood that part.
A million guys out there with an AZ license, but how many good drivers are there?
From Mark's experience as an owner, there were probably less than 100 in the whole country, or else they went into hiding whenever Mark was around. Knowing his ability to find trouble in the unlikeliest places, Mark wouldn't be surprised if the latter was at least partly true. Around Kingston, Mark pulled into a rest station for a bite to eat. He parked Motherlode as close to the restaurant as he could, hoping it might help keep the truck safe, then went inside. As he stood in line, waiting to order a burger and fries, he noticed a familiar face waiting two spots ahead of him. Johnny Jones. The guy acted like he hadn't heard Mark, or maybe Mark was mistaken.
Hey, Johnny Jones!
The guy in front finally turned around. He stared at Mark for a moment, then a look of recognition broke over his face.
Dalton?
That's right!
I haven't seen you in
a couple of years.
Mark had helped Johnny Jones out with a company that had been cheating him out of a lot of money it owed to him. He also managed to get Johnny a just-in-time load headed for the GM plant in Oshawa, then held the load ransom until the company agreed to pay Johnny what they owed him. The line moved forward and the woman behind the counter asked for Johnny's order.
Get your lunch and we'll talk while we eat.
Johnny nodded and placed his order. Mark joined him a few minutes later at a table by the window overlooking the parking lot.
You still with that company? What was it, JJ&G?
Nah, after you helped me with that just-in-time load, they didn't want to deal with me anymore.
Go figure.
Which was fine with me since I didn't want to deal with them either.
You still driving your own rig?
Oh, nope. I sold it, paid off the loan, and got a job as a company driver. Less money, but less headaches, too.
Mark nodded. That was true enough.
You still happy as a company driver?
Well, actually, I'm looking to buy my own truck again. I've been saving my money, and I've got enough for a down payment. If I could only find a decent used truck at a good price.
Mark just stared at Johnny, a smile slowly starting to break across his face. This was just too perfect, even for him.
You're looking to buy a truck?
I haven't found anything yet, but I'm looking.
Well, maybe your search is over.
What do you mean?
I'm looking to sell Motherlode.
The Motherlode? Mark Dalton's famous Motherlode?
Yep. In fact, it's right over there.
You quitting driving?
Oh, no, I can't. It's in my blood.
Johnny looked out the window and probably noticed the smashed headlight and dented fender.
Well, then what's wrong with the truck?
Nothing. I just bought myself a new one and haven't gotten rid of the old one yet. You interested?
Oh, you bet! Although...
Oh, great. Hey, let's take a look.
They spent a solid 20 minutes walking around the truck, Johnny doing a thorough circle check while Mark hung back and watched.
Oh, looks good inside and out.
Well, you know me, Johnny. I'm a professional, and I take good care of my truck.
Oh, I know. It's just that...
What?
Well, this is a Pete after all, and broken headlight and dent fender aside, it's in good shape and would probably cost more money than I got.
Maybe, maybe not.
You don't have to smooth talk me about the truck, Mark. I know it's in good shape. It's just a question of money. How much I have and how much you want.
How much do you have?
You know negotiations don't work that way. How much you want for it?
Well, I was thinking 50,000.
That's a little bit more than I had in mind.
Which was how much?
Well, somewhere around 35,000. Hey, I know the truck's worth more, but that's all I can afford at the moment. And believe me, after nearly losing a couple of trucks, I know exactly what I can and can't afford.
No, that's not why I'm laughing.
Well, then why are you?
I'm laughing because while I was looking for 50,000, but I was prepared to settle for 35,000. Then I run into you, and that's just what you have to spend. It's almost like somebody up there, maybe even Motherlode herself, is trying to tell me something.
That much was true. Sure, he could probably sell the truck for more money, but here was Johnny Jones, a driver Mark knew would take good care of Motherlode. What was the value of such peace of mind? Mark had already tried to make money off Motherlode and had failed miserably. Maybe he'd be better off just making sure she went to a good driver, regardless of how much money he earned from the deal. It wasn't a very smart business move, but Mark had already proven he was a lousy businessman. Maybe he and his truck would be better off simply being a good person.
Oh, maybe I could afford 36,000 or even 40,000, but I'd have to talk it over with my wife first.
No need. I'll sell it to you for 35,000 as long as you promise to take good care of her.
Of course I will.
Then it's a deal.
The two men shook. Mark felt a little regret over not holding out for more, at least to cover what he'd lost trying to be a big shot owner. But the more he thought about it, the more he realized the lesson he'd learned had come cheap at $1,000. And besides, The warm feeling he felt shaking Johnny's hand was absolutely priceless.
If you enjoyed this Mark Dalton adventure, be sure to check out next month's episode featured on the following action-packed titles: Deathland Zero, Encounter, Jackknife Number One, Jackknife. And be sure to pick up the compilation of all 9 Mark Dalton episodes on Reefer Madness.
If you can't find that hot graphic audio title you're looking for, just head to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD or MP3 disc format. Or, the fastest and cheapest way, download that puppy and play it on any of the many devices that'll play Windows Media. And if you're on the road or just a total computer feeb, snatch up the phone and call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220 or www.graphicaudio.net.